This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This show is jam-packed with the voices of the climate crisis from around the world. We start in Moscow, where vast areas of Siberia have burned in September, the month when cold rains or even snow should have ended the fire season. It's yet another big sign of a world entering a time of climate chaos. Then we go for uncomfortable new science from Germany. A new major source of greenhouse gases has been uncovered, something completely missing from reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and all the talk of the remaining carbon budget. No, I'm not talking about methane from the Arctic or the shrinking reflective power of ice and snow around the planet. It's the forests. Even if we stopped all deforestation today, the carbon from tropical forests already cut in places like Brazil and Indonesia will continue to rise up into the atmosphere. It's as though we've uncovered a second fossil fuel civilization. Finally, the energy report that fuels even more stringent warnings from activist writers like Bill McKibben and George Monbiot. We talk with an author of the Sky's the Limit report that says multinational companies and oil states should abandon right now any further exploration for new oil, gas, or coal. That means their book assets are inflated, and that means pension funds and investors should flee fossil fuel companies and their dependent industries. I don't think that goes far enough, and I'll tell you why. I'm Alex. Welcome to Radio EcoShock, where minds and hearts become energized. Alexei Yaroshenko leads the Forest Campaign for Greenpeace Russia. He has a PhD in botany and has published on the boreal forest. Yaroshenko says the fire danger in Russia is much greater than officially admitted. If so, the carbon plume going into the atmosphere is far more dangerous than reported. The whole story is lately missing in the West. From Moscow, Radio EcoShock is pleased to welcome Dr. Alexei Yaroshenko. Hello, Alexei.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. I want to start with this. On September 9, the Washington Post reported that Greenpeace firefighters were beaten up in southern Russia by masked men carrying pistols and weapons. Alexei, who are these firefighters?
These firefighters is a team that we have for more than 10 years, people who are trained as a professional firefighter. They are volunteers, but they are professional forest firefighters. So this was an expedition of 14 people. Seven of them had official diploma of the head of firefighting team, forest firefighting team. And they do this work for many years, and they are especially good specialists in fighting peat and reed fires, tall grass fires.
Is it common for environmentalists to be attacked like that in Russia?
It is not day-to-day practice, everyday practice, but it is not very uncommon. So it happens from time to time. It was more common in the 90s, then there was some break in beginning of this century, and now it is going to be more and more common.
Let's get to the really big story, the fires of Siberia. Please take as long as you like to describe what has happened this summer and then the current situation.
This summer in Siberia, we had one of the biggest fire catastrophes for last decade, but actually we have catastrophic fires every year since 2010 in different parts of Russia. There are two reasons for it. One of the reasons is climate change. We have longer summer, longer drought. And another reason is that we have very unclever changes in our forest legislation. Actually, our forest service and forest firefighting system was destroyed by the new forest code that came in force in 2007. And this year we have about, we cannot say exact number of hectares yet, but it's definitely more than 8 million hectares of forest that were burned this year by forest fires. And what is unusual that we had big catastrophic fires in September. Usually in September in Siberia there is a autumn or beginning of winter even. So there should be cold rain and sometimes snow this time. But now we have catastrophic fires. The area burned was about 2 million hectares on the peak, and this peak was about September 21st, 22nd.
Many of my listeners do not know the map of Russia. Can you explain for our international audience where the worst fires have been burning?
This year it was near Baikal Lake and upstream of Yenisei and Angara and Lena rivers. So Yenisei and Lena are the biggest rivers in Siberia. So they start more or less in the same area in eastern Siberia. And there are two major administrative regions that were burned. It's Krasnoyarsk and Irkutsk. So most of fires happened in Krasnoyarsk and Irkutsk.
On September 23rd, the Siberian Times reported, and I quote, "So far, more than 3,000 residents have signed a petition to President Vladimir Putin and Emergencies Minister Vladimir Puchkov on website change.org under the headline, 'City of Bratsk is choking from smoke.'" Alexei Yaroshenko, please tell us, where is Bratsk and what are the residents experiencing there?
Bratsk is second biggest city in Irkutsk region. It's about 230,000 people. There is a big hydropower station and a big pulp mill. This city was covered with heavy smoke for about a month, and the peak was a week ago. So the schools were closed. It's not the only city where schools were closed. We had about 5 or 6 cities where schools were closed because of heavy smoke, but Bratsk is one of them. And people were very dismissed by the regional government and by all the authorities that instead of fighting fires, they tried to hide all of them, just simply not to report them and say that everything is under control, there are no big fires, and we have nothing to do.
But satellite pictures show a huge haze hanging over Siberia in September.
Yes, our estimation that there are about 5 million people that were affected by this smoke, and this is a large event for Siberia, which is generally not very populated, so 5 million, for Siberia, it's a huge amount of people. It's several dozens of schools that were closed, and there were many other problems, not only closing schools, and also there was problems with safety on traffic. For example, in some rivers, the navigation was closed or suspended for some time because of this smoke that didn't allow to see the shores and other ships.
And they need those rivers for supplies, I hear.
Yes, they need, because the rivers in Siberia are the major traffic lines. So it's also important to have these rivers open for traffic, for navigation. And the winter is coming, so they will be frozen quite soon.
All right. Now, on September 20th, the Siberian Times also reported, and I quote, "A fire threat to the Eastern Siberia Pacific Ocean pipeline led the Irkutsk Oil Company to suspend supplies of oil," said the official representative. Alexei, how close did these fires get to pipeline facilities?
They just come to the vicinity of pipelines in several in few times. They just reach the pipeline, but pipeline is under the ground, so most probably that this suspension of operations was related not to the fires that reached the pipelines, but to the heavy smoke that reached infrastructure like compression stations and so on. So people could not walk there. It's not very clear what was the story. Hidden from people who want to get information, but seems that the biggest reason for suspension was not the fire itself, but the smoke.
Has Siberia been warmer than usual in the last few years?
A bit warmer, but more problem that it was much drier, yes.
And you think that that is partly due to climate change?
Yes, it's definitely due to the climate change, because the trend is big and the area affected is very big. It cannot be related to any local activities.
How can you say, Alexei, that there are more fires than the government is reporting? What proof is there?
The proof comes from the remote sensing from satellites. So we are watching the satellites and analyzing the development of fires on the day-to-day basis. Also, there is a state-based system, ISDM, that monitor fires. It's also based on the remote sensing. It allows to get real data on forest fires, but these data are not used in official statistics and they are not used for real management of fires.
Why would the government neglect to report the real situation?
I think that the main reason that almost every governmental bureaucrat want to keep his warm place and to stay on his position, not depending on the reality, and for him is much better and safer to hide information, to show that everything is okay, that to show problems. Nobody was punished in the last 7 years in Russia for hiding information about the forest fires, but many people were punished for bad statistics. So statistics, the paper reporting is more important for our governmental people than real situation in forests.
How has social media helped to alert the world to this problem?
There is some help from social media, but the problem is that many people who live in small settlements that are most affected in the forest, they are not very linked to internet, to social media, and so on. So people who are most suffering from forest fires, they are neglected, they are isolated, so it's very difficult to them to show this information. And also they are, of course, afraid of state, because it's very easy to be punished if you are living in small settlement for saying bad things about activity of local governments.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from Moscow. My guest is Dr. Alexey Yaroshenko, the top forest campaigner for Greenpeace Russia. Here in Canada, we also have more and more fires in our boreal forests because those areas are so remote and with few settlements here, our government lets them burn as a natural force. The Russian government also doesn't fight such fires. What is the difference?
I think that difference is less and less with time. The major difference is now in accessibility of information. For example, in Canada, in US, we can watch the databases on fires to watch a real situation. So there is no intention to hide fires. There may be mistakes, but there is no intentional hiding of fires. In our country, we have false information on forest fires and even no intention from the governmental side to make this information real. This is maybe the major difference. I think that the problems that are related to climate change, they are very common to all countries with large forests.
Yes, it's happening in Alaska too. Alexey Yaroshenko, the Siberian Times quotes you saying, "The scale of the wildfires in eastern Siberia can be compared with the catastrophe of 2010 in European Russia and the Urals. I did a special report on those 2010 Russian wildfires. They were very frightening. And at the time, I interviewed Vladimir Chuprov from Greenpeace Russia." Why do you say this year's fires are even larger?
Because the area of forest fires is bigger now. For example, in 2010, the total area burned was about 5 million hectares. It was not the heaviest year in Russian forest fire history. Now we have at least 8 million hectares of forest fires, and I think that will be much more than 8 million. In 2010, fires happened in most populated areas of European Russia and Ural. So they were very visible. They make huge damage for settlements, for people's health, and so on. Now fires are burning in much less populated area, and they are not very visible for society. But the scale of fires is bigger, and amount of smoke is also bigger. And the loss of forest will be bigger than we had in 2010.
Greenpeace Russia continues to alert the international media to this problem. What do you want people to do?
First of all, we want to destroy the system of firelight, the system when the fires are hidden, and this allows government to do nothing with these fires, not to solve the problems that lead to these fires. This is one of the major tasks of our anti-fire work. And I think that more information about fires will help to achieve this task. The more opinion from people we will have to the forest fires, the easier it will be to destroy the system of light.
Now, once that is done and the government is more open about the fires that exist, what should the Russian government do? I mean, climate change is warming Russia faster than most other places on Earth.
Yes, that's true. And we are afraid that Siberia will be one of the regions most affected by climate change. There are some issues that can be resolved. For example, one of the major reasons of forest fire in Siberia is inaccurate prescribed burning or grass burning. Not only prescribed, but grass burning by different people for different reasons. So we are fighting for many years to get the ban for any uncontrolled grass burning, and it gives some results. So we got this ban on paper in November last year. It already helped to decrease amount of fires in the first wave in spring, in April, May, and June. We have about one-third less fires than we have usually. So we need also to continue and to expand this ban to exclude massive grass burning from land use practices. Our estimation that it will decrease about twice the amount of fires and will make easier to fight with remaining, because amount of fires is one of the bigger problems. And second, we need to restore professional firefighting service that was destroyed 10 years ago by the new Russian forest code. The major thing that was done by this forest code is destruction of economic basis of the forest management. So before this forest code, since the very old times, Peter the Great, Tsar, it was 300 years ago, forestry developed in Russia as a normal economic branch of economy. So it had some own money that was earned from forest, and this money was spent for protection of forest for firefighting. Now, the new forest code broke this link, so now the firefighting system completely depends on the budget financing, and budget has no money for this work. So we need to restore the normally working forestry as a branch of economy.
As we finish up, is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners?
Yes, I think too that we should keep in mind that the problems that we have now, it's only a sign of the new problems that we will get sooner, that the climate is warming and we have to be very careful with forest and with fires, because we have every year more and more signs that climate change will destroy a lot of forests and increase a lot of problems.
From Moscow, we've been speaking with the top forest campaigner at Greenpeace Russia, Alexei Yaroshenko. Alexei, thank you so much for telling us about this news.
Yeah, thank you.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Stay tuned for more on the climate crisis from Germany and America. Former NASA scientist James Hansen often speaks of global warming still in the pipeline. The actual contributions to atmospheric change have been masked by the dimming effect of other air pollution. Our next guest might call that a climate debt, except she has documented a different source of greenhouse gases that apparently cannot be stopped now. The press has labeled them zombie emissions. Stick with me, please. This is important. We're going to reach out to the lead author, Isabel Rosa. She has a PhD in computational ecology and works with the German Center for Integrative Biodiversity Research. From Leipzig, Germany, Isabel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Well, Alex, it's good to be here.
I realize this debt, as you call it, coming due involves more than climate change, but let's start with that. What is the source of the so-called zombie emissions you and your team published about last summer in the journal Current Biology?
Tropical forests have been under great pressure over the last few decades, and trees have been cut down at a really fast rate. When the trees are cut down, some of the wood is removed, some of it is burned, and some of it is left at the site to decay naturally as it decomposes. And so these emissions that were called zombie emissions by a journalist are actually these emissions that result from the decomposition of these wood or organic matter that is left on the site, and it decomposes over time.
It's hard for people to picture. I've seen clear cuts in North America, and there are massive amounts of wood left. Even when they make some burning piles, there's just huge amounts of carbon left on the forest floor.
Yeah, it's So in the tropics, it depends a little bit on what the forest has been cut down for. So for instance, maybe in the past, deforestation was more traditional or more small scale for slash and burn agriculture. But in more recent years, large scale agriculture for mechanized agriculture, remove much more wood from the site than previous types of deforestation. But it, like you said, it's still a large amount of wood that is left to decompose and where the forest was standing before.
How can we understand the magnitude of carbon emissions due to be released by tropical deforestation? Do you have some numbers for us?
So our estimates show that if we don't do anything, and it's important to say that there are some ways in which we can help, not preventing, but at least capturing back some of these emissions. So we estimated that these emissions would be the same as stopping deforestation completely, and these emissions would correspond to having 5 to 10 more years of deforestation, which I think is significant if we think of how many forests are being cut down currently.
So even if we stop this relentless wave of cutting down tropical forests, the emissions pictured in your paper would still continue for perhaps a decade.
Yes, exactly. It's and that tells us how much we, as humans, have been having a strong impact on our planet and a long-lasting impact.
What methods did you use to calculate the amount of carbon in fallen trees and vegetation? I mean, you did it on an international scale. That's a big project.
Yes, indeed. And the project is based on computer simulations, not based on field data or field data collection. So we used maps that were developed by my co-author Matthew Smith from Microsoft Research Cambridge, where he estimated the potential carbon that was in those trees before they have been cut down. And then we superimposed our deforestation maps produced by my model to estimate how much carbon was lost over time.
But won't the trees grow back and suck up that carbon again?
Some of it, but the problem is a lot of these areas are actually being replaced by agricultural fields, which are not able to capture as much carbon as a tropical forest. It's a completely different ecosystem. And so I think it's important to understand that although some of the carbon can be recaptured, we really need to think of ways to accelerate or to allow for a greater recapture of the carbon by, for instance, incentivizing conservation and also restoration, particularly restoring degraded areas that aren't being used for agriculture for whichever reason. These should be areas where we should actively create an incentive for forest restoration.
Well, as we know, time after time, governments and even United Nations science reports underestimate the true amount of greenhouse gases reaching the atmosphere. They don't count aircraft emissions. They haven't counted some Arctic gases. To your knowledge, did the IPCC reports or the Paris Accord include the emissions from ruined forests?
To my knowledge, these emissions from the decay of the wood have not been taken into account, at least with the level of detail that we were able to do in our study.
So with the data from your paper, do we know enough now to add these future emissions to calculations of the global carbon budget?
There's still uncertainties that I think need to be addressed, and I think I try to focus a little bit on that on the study as well, because for instance we know now we're getting better and better at monitoring deforestation rates with better and better satellite data, but there's still large sources of uncertainty in terms of the amount of biomass that is actually in the forest. But I think I hope my study is a contribution towards improving our knowledge on the true contribution of deforestation and land cover change to climate change.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Isabel Rosa. She's the lead author of a new paper on the unexpected blowback from tropical deforestation. And Isabella, the other shocking surprise in your paper is that the process of forest breakdown will accelerate the disappearance of species from this planet. How is that possible?
So there are a lot of species that are forest-dependent, so their preferred habitat for surviving it's forest, and we've been cutting this down so fast, and the species cannot survive in whatever ecosystem replaces the forest. And so we've shown that with 60 years of tropical deforestation, we've lost already more than 40 species that we will not be able to replace. And if we do not act to restore this forest that we have destroyed, then we will lose an even higher number of species over the next few years as a result of all the deforestation in the past.
Why are these extinctions delayed, Isabella, when the forests have been cut down? Why don't the species die right away but appear years later?
There's called a relaxation period where species may try to adapt to the new environment, and so that's why there's not an immediate loss of the species, but over time, as species are not able to survive, they might go extinct.
So as you did your study, what countries had the greatest buildup of yet-to-be-released greenhouse gases and the greatest threat of loss of species? Where is the big tropical deforestation happening?
As it's well known, I believe Brazil had a very significant amount of deforestation, especially since the 70s until the early 2000s, with a recent slowdown. And overall, over the 60-year period, Brazil was definitely the country where we estimated a higher loss of carbon and a greater number of species extinctions. This was followed by Indonesia, and much less so in Congo, where deforestation is still very low, but it seems to be increasing, unfortunately.
You know, I've been wondering if this extra carbon enhances the trend of drying out trees in a hotter world. I mean, there's concern right now that millions of trees have died in the United States. Other scientists suggest some of the Amazon may convert to grasslands, partly due to climate change. Does that make these emissions, in a way, a positive feedback where deforestation may lead to more deforestation?
We didn't account for that, but it could be, yeah, because we're the tropics is a very large area in the globe, and it has been contributing a lot to the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. So it's not something that I have analyzed myself, but I believe that it could have an effect.
You know, it's interesting. Your paper really reaches out to two very distinct groups of activists. You have activists and scientists and policymakers who work on climate change and others who seem to work on forests and species extinction. Why do you think a single mechanism is leading to such diverse changes to both species and the atmosphere?
I think the overall glue, so to speak, is the vegetation and the habitat. So when you destroy such a biodiversity and biomass-rich ecosystem such as tropical forests, and you replace it by an agricultural field, you have a very big impact not only on species but also on carbon cycle. And I think it's important in the future to consider conservation and restoration actions that actually look at multiple angles and not only on one or the other.
I remember talking to one scientist, he was actually working in the boreal forest, who said, we might actually be better if we just buried the excess wood, because at least that would slow down and add carbon to the soil.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It would be a massive project, of course, and we could never do it, but...
No.
So you've made kind of a prediction about continuing emissions in this paper. Is there a way to test that, or does it need testing?
Continuing emissions from active deforestation, you mean?
Yes.
Unfortunately, I think it's a clear pattern, at least for now. And although in Brazil there was a slowdown in deforestation rates, we could see an acceleration of these rates in the Congo and also to some extent in Southeast Asia. So we live in a world where human population is still growing, and we are very demanding and high consuming humans. So we need to be able to produce food to feed all these people. So there's still incentive to the agricultural business. And unfortunately, the more production has been coming not from intensifying existing agricultural fields, but coming from destroying natural habitats and particularly destroying tropical forests. And I think we need a bigger effort as a community to prevent future tropical deforestation.
Well, I completely agree, but as we wrap up, I want to ask you on a personal note, what is computational ecology?
A fancy name for an ecologist that works essentially with behind a computer and on a desk and does a lot of modeling and not so much field work as that, like she wishes.
So what are you working on now or next?
So my research interests are based on how we can use land cover change scenarios to inform policy and decision making. So at the moment, I'm studying how we can use these scenarios to help implementing, for instance, payments for ecosystem services policy that would allow us to create incentives for forest restoration, for example, particularly in the Atlantic forest in Brazil, or how we can use scenarios of future land cover change to inform decision makers on the impact of building new infrastructures. And I'm doing that for the Serengeti National Park.
Those are also big projects, and I look forward to your research. We've been talking with Dr. Isabel Rosa from the German Center for Integrative Biodiversity Research in Leipzig. She's the lead author of one of the more important publications of the summer of 2016, I think. The title is The Environmental Legacy of Modern Tropical Deforestation, as published in the journal Current Biology. You can find links to Isabel and the paper in my Radio EcoShock blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Isabel, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you so much, Alex. It was a pleasure talking to you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Right now, this year and every year, giant oil, gas, and coal multinationals and nationalized fossil fuel countries are spending a large part of their income trying to find new fields, more wells, and new mines. They are pushing national governments to support or even fund more pipelines, train lines, ports, and infrastructure. You know, you're seeing it in the news all around you. They want to make more carbon power happen. Media is carefully crafted to make us fearful of a change, to make us support more subsidies and cheap permissions. A powerful new report details why the atmosphere cannot withstand any more exploration and development by the fossil fuel industry or the national states. But even this information, startling as it may be for the public and investors, doesn't go far enough to avoid a climate catastrophe. After the interview, I'll explain why.
Radio EcoShock.
How much greenhouse gas will come from our existing energy system as it is with no further exploration or development? Those numbers, believe it or not, are hard to get. A group called Oil Change International found the figures, and they've released them in a free report. The title is The Sky's the Limit: Why the Paris Climate Goals Require a Managed Decline of Fossil Fuel Production. To talk about all this, we've reached David Turnbull. He's the campaigns director of Oil Change International and a contributor to this new report. David, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, right now in the United States, Native Americans are trying to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline construction. And at the same time, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau must decide whether to allow a pipeline expansion from the tar sands to Vancouver Harbor. What does your report say about new pipeline construction?
Our report comes to a pretty clear conclusion, which is that any new fossil fuel infrastructure that will incentivize new development is off limits if we want to actually achieve the goals that we've set forward when it comes to the climate. So those pipelines, the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota, the Kinder Morgan Pipeline in Canada, and any pipelines really that will actually incentivize new fossil fuel development need to be off the table.
People are fighting wars right now in the Middle East with the hopes of building new pipelines from Qatar and through Turkey and all sorts of things. So this has geopolitical implications as well as climate implications.
That's absolutely right. And of course, climate change itself has huge geopolitical implications. We're seeing major conflicts being arisen because of the impacts of climate change in Africa and elsewhere, where resource wars and concerns and issues arising from droughts and other climate impacts are so impactful on geopolitics. This report, it is incredibly important for geopolitics because of the power of the fossil fuel industry around the world. What we're saying is that they need to stop digging new mines, new wells, and we need our government to take action to make sure that's the case. It's a big result, but it's also backed by science, and it's something that we have to achieve.
Well, we'll get into how you did the report, but meanwhile, I have to say the fossil fuel industry spends billions and billions looking for new sources of oil and gas. It's part of their game. It's how they keep their share prices up, depending on claiming those new reserves. How can they keep share prices up and their business going if they just stop exploring for more?
It's a good question, and it actually points to a problem that we have with the way that fossil fuel industries are valued by investors and Wall Street. As you say, they need to keep finding new fossil fuels if they want to keep their stock price high. But what we now know is that finding those new fossil fuels is really anathema to taking action on climate change. So we need to figure out a way for governments to pursue a managed decline of the fossil fuel industry, where we move away from fossil fuels quickly.
And what about countries which are still heavily reliant on coal? I'm thinking of India and China. What does this report say to them?
Well, there's a really important point around India in particular, which is that, you know, some of these countries have not really been a huge part of the problem of climate change historically. Of course, now we see emissions rising around the world, but the historic nature of climate change is such that a country like India has not contributed nearly as much to the problem as the United States or other rich countries. So what we're seeing and what a lot of people are calling for is for rich countries to help ensure that there's support that is needed to help poorer countries around the world, particularly like in Africa, to ensure that they are able to move beyond fossil fuels to help bring energy access to their poor communities, but do it in a way that skips over fossil fuels and goes straight to renewable energy. And they need support from rich countries like the United States and in Europe to help make that a reality.
You know, I've interviewed hundreds of scientists now at this point, and I've developed this gut feeling personally that if we want to keep the climate we evolved with, we can't burn any more fossil fuels. But David Turnbull, your group's report isn't really saying that. It isn't saying stop burning today, is it?
That's right. We're not saying that we need to turn off the taps overnight. We recognize that we need to have a rapid transition away from fossil fuels. That means both rapid, we need to do it quickly, but it is a transition. we need to recognize that we can't shift to renewable energy completely overnight, but we need to do so quickly. And our analysis shows that the current mines, the current wells of fossil fuels around the world are enough to bring us to the brink of climate chaos. So we certainly need to stop digging new mines and wells, and we need to find a way to actually close some of those existing mines early and transition to renewables as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, according to the calculations in this report, we can't even allow the existing oil and gas fields or the coal mines to pump out all they've got before they close them. Is that correct?
That's correct. We've looked at two different temperature goals when we're making our analysis. So the first is a 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels of warming. That's a goal that's been agreed for a number of years by global governments around the world. And it's one that a lot of people say is the maximum that we can see if we want to achieve climate safety. But there's a second goal, which is 1.5 degrees. That's half a degree less of warming. And recently, there's been a lot of discussion about that actually being the safest level of warming that we can withstand, or the highest level of warming that we can withstand. So what we've seen in our analysis is that if we want to achieve 1.5 degrees of warming or less, we can't burn all of the fossil fuels that are in the existing fossil fuel development projects. And even if we were to shut off coal immediately, the oil and gas and the wells that are already dug could also bring us past that 1.5 degree goal. So the short story is, yes, we may have to look at shutting down some of those mines and wells before their lifespan is complete. And that's going to be a really challenging thing to do, but it's something that the science is pointing towards.
I guess all of us are wondering, myself and our listeners, what international or national laws could possibly limit the production of these mega corporations and their ability to bribe and fund political elections? Can anybody really stop them from producing as much as they can sell?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that we're seeing a global movement already developing to keep fossil fuels in the ground, standing up to basically every single major fossil fuel infrastructure project in the North American continent, let alone across the world. So, you know, there's communities that are standing up in amazing ways to stop new fossil fuel development. If you coupled that with real, strong, serious government action to limit fossil fuel production on federal lands, to stop fossil fuel subsidies, we're talking about billions of dollars each year of government money going to support fossil fuel development. If you saw strong government action that really sort of came on the heels of this amazing community action, yeah, we could stand up to the industry and turn them around.
So, David, why is it so difficult to find out the amount of greenhouse gases our current fossil fuel infrastructure is producing?
Well, you know, the information's out there, but it's really dispersed. You have to compile all of these different companies of annual reports and reporting to the governments and such. And so we've worked by looking at a database, an industry database, not a lot of nonprofits actually have access to, but we've gained access to it, and we're using it to look at these reserves and really get a full, complete picture and understanding.
Who put up the money to get what you needed for the report?
We're funded by a number of different foundations that are concerned about addressing climate change, as well as individual donors or supporters around the country. And yeah, it's a decent investment. But, you know, we like to think that at Oil Change International, we're helping to democratize that data. We're helping to bring it to the public forum and ensure that everyone that needs to be aware of what's really going on in the fossil fuel industry is aware of that.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. My name is Alex Smith, and my guest is David Turnbull, the campaign director for the nonprofit group Oil Change International. We're looking at their new report, which says if we want to avoid a catastrophic climate shift, the days of exploring for more oil and gas and coal, or building new pipelines and ports, those days are over. Well, David, some of the Middle Eastern countries routinely hide or misreport their oil and gas assets. How does anybody know how big their reserves are?
you know, there's a bit of a combination of geology, just simply having a scientific understanding of what those formations actually look like, and, you know, some investigative sort of analysis. The people behind the fossil fuel industry database that we've been working with, you know, they're experts. They spend night and day looking at this stuff, and they make what may actually be conservative estimates of what's out there. And whether we're off by a small amount here or there, we don't think we are, but the scale of the problem is so abundantly clear that the misreporting or potential, you know, differences in specific numbers doesn't change the actual conclusion, which is that we know we have far too many fossil fuels out there, and our existing fossil fuel development will bring us past what we want to achieve in terms of climate safety.
Well, Bill McKibben of 350.org has written about the terrible new math, and he quotes this report. What sort of numbers are in this report?
So some of the numbers that Bill cites, which are sort of at the heart of our analysis, is that scientists, climate scientists, have said if we want to have a two-thirds chance of staying below those 2 degrees of Celsius of global warming, we can release 800 gigatons more CO2 into the atmosphere. But what our data shows, or the data that we've accessed and analyzed shows, is that current coal mines, oil and gas wells, and fossil fuel development currently operation have 942 gigatons worth of CO2 embedded in them. So as Bill says, the math problem is quite simple. 942 gigatons is far bigger than 800 gigatons, which climate scientists say is the safe amount. And so that's our problem. If you want to look even further at the 1.5 degree goal, which many around the world, including all global leaders, actually have signed up to, aspiring to stay close to, that 800 gigatons actually goes down to 353 gigatons of CO2 being the safe amount that we can emit moving forward. So again, 942 gigatons worth of CO2 in the fossil fuel development projects around the world, and only 353 gigatons of that is actually safe if we want to hit our 1.5 degree global warming target.
Well, you know, that's interesting because the SEC, the organization in charge of the American Stock Exchange, are investigating Exxon's reporting of their assets, but they're doing it because the price of oil has fallen so much and Exxon still has it marked very high on their books. But there may be another reason to investigate those assets if the figures in your report are true, because they just won't be able to burn perhaps only a third of what they claim.
That's right. You know, we think that new fossil fuel development is a terrible investment, and we're seeing that shift amongst a number of financial experts and institutional investors. That's a large part of the global fossil fuel divestment movement, is not only a moral question of whether we should be investing our money and our retirement funds and other finances in these companies that are bringing about climate chaos, but also, frankly, is it actually a good investment? And more, that question is a serious one, and it's one that a lot of investors are answering with a no. This isn't a good investment because some of these fossil fuels are going to stay in the ground, because we know that our governments are going to take strong action to address climate change, because the world is so calling and demanding for that action to take place. So, you know, the SEC investigation of Exxon is a really interesting moment. It's a really interesting initiative by SEC to really question this accounting practice of Exxon, but also more broadly for the oil and fossil fuel industry writ large. There's a question of whether these assets that they're spending a lot of money and investment to find and to put onto their books are actually worth much because of that fact that we're going to need to keep them in the ground.
So, David Turnbull, what kind of decline do we need? How much and how fast? Do we know that yet?
Well, we know we need to be off fossil fuels in the next couple decades, really. If you want to achieve 1.5 degrees of warming, of staying below 1.5 degrees of warming, we're talking about moving off of fossil fuels completely in a very short while. If you're talking about 2 degrees of warming, you might have until the middle of the century, but that's being a little bit, that's giving some leeway. But we're really talking about a couple decades here to really take a serious global action to move away from fossil fuels. So time is short. And we're not saying turn off the taps for fossil fuels overnight, but we're saying we need to move quickly and really, really strongly away from fossil fuels. And that's why we subtitled this report talking about the need for a managed decline of the fossil fuel industry. We need our governments to take action, to work with the industry to move away from fossil fuels. And if we take that initiative now, we can do so in a way that allows for renewable energy to rise up and replace the fossil fuel industry in an organized fashion. If we wait a decade or longer, it's going to be a much, much more disruptive situation if we actually want to take the necessary action. Taking it now is a manageable situation. Taking it later is a much more difficult prospect.
Realistically, do we know whether alternative energy sources can be scaled up and built quickly enough to stay at 2 degrees C global mean heating or below?
The good news is that we do think that it's the case that we can scale up renewable energy in time. Our report, The Sky's Limit, references a number of different studies from Stanford professors and other academics that lay out plans to achieve 100% renewable energy in the time that we need to in order to achieve our climate goals. It can do so in a way that also presents a just transition for the workers in the fossil fuel industry so that they can be retrained, they can have assistance programs to ensure that they're taken along in this transition and not left behind. But the good news of this report, if they're, you know, amidst all of the scary news, is that we can do it. That the analysis is there. The renewable energy industry is booming. Solar, wind, geothermal, all of these energy renewable energy technologies are becoming far cheaper and far more available, and that's exactly what we need.
Before this report, I have to admit I hadn't heard of Oil Change International. Where did this group come from?
We're just over a decade old, and we come from a number of different individuals. Our founder, Steve Kretzmann, has been working on campaigns to move away from oil for a couple of decades, 25 years even, and we're full of campaigners and researchers who have been working on this issue for years. And we're really focused on ensuring that we are exposing the true costs of fossil fuels for our climate, for our communities, so that we can break down the barriers to a clean energy transition. So we put out reports like The Sky's Limit and other reports to expose what the real problem is, what the real problems with different pipeline proposals are, and those sorts of issues that are in the forefront of our politics. And we campaign hard with our supporters to push against these ill-sought proposals.
How can our listeners help get this report out there and working?
So we encourage everyone to go to priceofoil.org, which is our website, and read the report. Call your decision makers, call your legislators, your congresspeople, tell them about it, tell your friends about it, and just do whatever you can to organize in your communities against fossil fuel projects. There are so many out there, and there are so many amazing community uprisings and resistance, and I couldn't encourage you more to join in.
Can you give us any hints about the next project Oil Change International will be working on?
Well, you know, we're going to be working on really trying to implement what the logical conclusion of this report is, which is no new fossil fuel development. So we're working to try to make sure that our U.S. government is planning for that scenario, and that includes developing energy models that can look at what our fossil fuel use looks like if we are actually achieving our climate goals, and then basing decision-making off of that kind of a model. What we've seen is that we need to stop fossil fuel development. We want the government to take that on board as they consider new energy policy. So we're going to be working towards that so-called climate test, pushing that forward in our decision-making so that our government can plan for success in achieving our climate goals rather than plan for failure.
I'm Alex Smith, talking with David Turnbull. He's the campaigns director of Oil Change International and a contributor to the report titled The Sky's the Limit. You'll find links to all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info or go directly to the website priceofoil.org. David, thank you so much for your work and for talking with us today on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. In the news, there was just a major storm in Australia. On September 28th, a large part of South Australia lost electric power. The grid went down as hurricane-force winds blew over and destroyed large transmission towers. The Australian government, generally supported by the media monopoly owned by climate opponent Rupert Murdoch, turned this into an opportunity to question any move towards alternative energy. The state power operator said the source of electricity had nothing to do with it. It doesn't matter if you have solar power holding up those transmission towers against the wind or coal power. But the storm became a political club in the hands of the federal conservative government, which is pushing for gigantic new coal mines and a matching super coal port on the edge of the Great Barrier Reef. Here in Canada, one media company, Global Television, owned by Shaw Media, ran story after story about the poor rural customers paying too much for electricity. And that was because of green power, don't you see? That eventually whipped up enough public pressure that the government again blamed the green energy industry. The Ontario government promised to scale back wind and solar. The media chain sounded almost hopeful this would spread to the rest of Canada. A pullback from solar would benefit the beleaguered tar sands in Alberta and supposedly help the Canadian economy. Just one more example, the financial editor of Britain's Telegraph newspaper is Ambrose Evans-Pritchard. Ambrose can be very insightful. I read him. He's biased against Europe, sure. He's written often about the promise of alternative energy. And yet Evans-Pritchard can write an article totally hopeful about the return of higher oil prices and talking about rebuilding the fossil fuel industry as a good and necessary thing. Time and time again, the mainstream media willfully ignores the huge risk of such fossil fantasies. Time and again, they represent the powerful status quo of fossil fuel dominance in the world economy and our lives. Watch out for those stories that tell you solar or wind power is dangerous somehow, that it isn't real, that it can't power our lives. Quickly ask yourself, on every occasion, why are they telling you that? Who do they represent? But I have to say, now and again, even activists who have a good track record of fighting climate action, as David Turnbull certainly has, may not be able to face or focus on the awful truth of our situation. Or perhaps they can only tell us what we fossil-crazed public can tolerate right now. In this interview, David Turnbull says if we want to stay at or below 1.5 degrees C global warming, we may have a couple of decades to keep burning fossil fuels while we make a transition. I doubt that. Dr. Watson says we have already passed the 1.5 degree mark. Dr. James Hansen and others say using the global mean temperature measurement is dangerous in itself. And the reasons for that are a bit complicated. They involve our understanding of how sensitive the climate is, a belated comprehension of the role of warming of the oceans, and many risks not covered by straight temperature change. I mean, look at severe storms or the oceans turning more acidic. That just isn't covered by temperature. It doesn't tell the whole story. So I disagree that we have anything like two decades left to burn fossil fuels. Instead, we need emergency action, including planned power reductions or even rolling cuts if we have to, coupled with huge government financing to swing over to a combination of massively reduced energy use and very localized direct power by solar, wind, geothermal, or if we have to, hydropower. We may only have 5 years to save ourselves and protect our descendants from the worst. And that is why I support the call for planetary emergency action to save the climate. It's not a radical call. In fact, it's pretty well too late. It's a last-ditch call for sanity in the face of a super threat. There isn't time in this program to tell you much about the new Climate Chance campaign. A multifaceted group of experts, coordinated at this time, it seems, by the Landscape Architecture Foundation, is applying for a $100 million grant to develop an emergency action plan. The goal is to stave off the worst of climate change, to give ourselves and our descendants a chance. I'm looking into how I can help this appeal, perhaps by connecting the many famous scientists and authors that have been on the show. We'll see. You can get more details in the show blog for this week of October 5, 2016, published at ecoshock.info. And I'm just one person, so there's only so much I'll be able to do, but maybe you can see a way to fit climate action into your life. Can you talk it up and lead by example? Can we all do it, by the millions, until we find a way out of this carbon trap? Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock. I know it's a big investment of your time in these days of 140-character news bites and swirling headlines. It's my goal to help you tune into life-saving information as quickly and as powerfully as I can, directly from the source. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.